23. No one who loves. Let no one who loves be called altogether unhappy. Even love unreturned has its rainbow. J.M. Barrie, The Little Minister. Lucy could not help but be impressed, despite her conviction that it was wrong to be impressed by one's parents. Her mother had thrown together the traditional engagement party for James and Cordelia at a moment's notice, but it was so lovely, one might have guessed she had spent weeks planning it. The ballroom was bright with festive witch lights and candles. The walls hung about with ribbons in wedding gilt. Lace-draped tables bore plates of sweets, all in the theme of yellow and gold. Iced lemon pastries stuffed with cream, cut glass dishes of crystallized fruit, bonbons in fancy gold wrappings on an epergne, yellow plum and apricot tartlets. There were tumbling arrangements of flowers in urns on pillars around the ballroom, peonies, creamy camellias, sheaves of tall yellow gladioli, sprays of mimosa, pale gold roses and daffodils. The room was full of happy people. The quarantine was over, and everyone wanted to gather and gossip and congratulate Will and Tessa on the happiness of their offspring. Yet Tessa, even as she slipped an arm around Will's waist and smiled at Ida Rosewayne, who had arrived in a simply enormous hat, looked worried. Lucy guessed most people wouldn't see it, but she was a trained observer of her mother's moods, and besides, she was worried herself. She should have been filled with delight. Her brother and her closest friend were to be married. This was a moment to be happy ever after. But she knew the truth. Both James and Cordelia had told her that the marriage was a sham, a formality to save Cordelia's reputation. Tessa and Will did not know, nor did anyone want to tell them. Let them think James would be happy with Cordelia. Let them think it was all real. Lucy wished she thought it was real herself, and if that could not be the case, she wished she had someone to talk to about it. The Merry Thieves had all decided to treat the marriage as if it were a lark on James's part, and she could hardly voice her worries to Cordelia and make her feel even worse than she surely did already. Perhaps life was not like books. Perhaps life was never going to be like that. Her brother, elegant in black and white, had joined her parents in greeting guests. Gabriel and Cecily had just arrived with Anna, Alexander, and Christopher and distributed embraces and congratulations. Thomas had already come with his family. The Fairchilds had also arrived earlier, Matthew breaking away immediately from his family to make a beeline for the games room. Meanwhile, Charles was wandering around shaking hands and generally taking credit for the end of the attacks. The sound of carriages rattling into the courtyard made its own sort of odd music as the room began to fill up. The bridge stocks arrived, Ariadne thin but bright-eyed, and with them, Grace Blackthorne. Lucy tugged anxiously at the locket around her throat. Grace was lovely as new spring in a pale green dress, her silver blonde hair caught up in a waterfall of curls. Having seen Chiswick House up close, Lucy wondered again that Grace always seemed so splendidly turned out when she lived in a large pile of dirty bricks. Well, she had lived there. She lived with the Bridgestocks now, and would until her marriage to Charles. This was not a celebration for Grace, Lucy thought, looking at the other girl's pale face as she greeted Will and Tessa. James was perfectly composed, both he and Grace almost painfully polite as he received her congratulations. Did Grace mind? Lucy wondered. She was the one who had broken it off with James. She was marrying Charles, and Lucy did not want to forgive her for breaking James's heart. And yet, she watched Grace excuse herself and walk stiffly across the room toward Charles. They greeted each other like strangers or business partners, she thought. Oh, how she wished she could talk to Jesse. Perhaps he would be able to tell her how his sister was really feeling. Perhaps he would be able to tell her more than that.
She's here, whispered a voice in Lucy's ear. The guest of honour. Cordelia, you mean?
Lucy turned to see Jessamine hovering just beside her, near the tall French doors that led out onto the stone balcony. Through them, she could see an electric streetlight in the distance, casting a strange halo on the glass. Jessamine, though, cast no reflection.
"She looks lovely,"
Jessamine said. She gave a mysterious smile and vanished in the direction of the dessert table. Ghosts could not eat, but Jessamine still enjoyed looking at cakes. Cordelia did look lovely. She came in with her mother and brother, Sonar looking darkly regal in a green dress and black velvet russari. Alistair, well, Lucy hardly noticed Alistair until he handed his hat to the maid, and she realised he'd dyed his hair back to its natural black. It stood out strikingly against the brown of his skin. And then there was Cordelia, arrayed in a tapering gown of deep blue silk and golden tulle, sleeves ruched, and an opalescent brooch gathered together silk and gauze in a rosette between her breasts. Risa had dressed her hair with pearls, winking among the dark red strands. James took her hands and kissed her cheek. Both he and Cordelia looked aware of how many people were staring at them and probably whispering. Cordelia's announcement at the enclave meeting, though it had led to marriage, remained the shock of the season. Annoyed on their behalf, Lucy began to make her way across the room toward her family. She was headed off by Thomas, carrying their little cousin Alexander. Aunt Cecily and Uncle Gabriel had clearly palmed Alexander off on Thomas while they devoted themselves to party preparation. It was rather sweet to see tall, muscular Thomas carefully carrying a child, though Lucy would never tell him, so lest he get a swelled head. "Luce," Thomas said, "I must go greet Cordelia and Alistair. Could you take this awful brat?"
"Not a brat," said Alexander, who was sucking a piece of licorice. "I could," Lucy acknowledged. "I don't particularly want to, though." "Matthew," demanded Alexander darkly. Matthew was his favourite pseudo-relative. "Oscar."
"I don't think Oscar was invited, old chap," said Thomas, "what with him being a dog."
"I think you'd better go look for Matthew," said Lucy,
as Alexander appeared to be about to slump into despair. Thomas gave her a wry salute and headed into the crowd, which had only grown. Lucy saw with some delight that Magnus Bain had appeared, dressed rather like a pirate, with ruby buttons on his waistcoat and ruby jewels in his ears. He definitely raised the tone of the party. She was halfway across the room when Charles, wobbling a bit as if he'd had too much to drink, climbed up onto a low bench and tapped his family ring against the glass. "Excuse me," he called, as the noise in the room began to quiet. "I've something I'd like to say." The Herondales had been so immediately kind, welcoming Cordelia to their family. She did not know how to look them in the face, knowing it was all a lie. She was not Will and Tess's new daughter. She and James would be divorced in a year. James had been horrifically kind too. In the time since the engagement, Cordelia had convinced herself she had somehow trapped him into marriage. She knew perfectly well that if she hadn't thrown her reputation away to protect him, he'd be in the prisons of the Silent City. He'd been obliged to propose after that. He did smile at her whenever he looked at her, that lovely smile that seemed to say she was a miracle or a revelation. But it didn't help. James had a good heart, that was all. He didn't love her, and that would not change. To her immense shock, Alistair had been a great support through the past few days. He'd brought her tea, told her jokes, played chess with her, and generally kept her mind off things. They had talked very little about Elias's return. She didn't think he'd left her alone in the house at all, not even to go see Charles. Speaking of which, Charles had climbed on a bench and was calling out that he had something to say, creating a racket that quickly got the attention of the room. Everyone looked immensely surprised, including Tessa and Will. Sonar frowned, clearly thinking Charles was very rude. She didn't know the half of it. Cordelia thought darkly. "Let me be the first to raise a glass to the happy couple," said Charles, doing just that. "To James Herondale and Cordelia Carstairs. I wish to add personally that James, my brother's parabatai, has always been like a younger brother to me." "A younger brother he accused of vandalizing greenhouses across our fair nation," muttered Will. "As for Cordelia Carstairs, how to describe her?" Charles went on. "Especially when one has not bothered to get to know her at all," murmured James. "She is both beautiful and fair," said Charles, leaving Cordelia to wonder what the difference was, "as well as being brave. I am sure she will make James as happy as my lovely Grace makes me." He smiled at Grace, who stood quietly near him, her face a mask. "That's right. I am formally announcing my intention to wed Grace Blackthorne. You will all be invited, of course." Cordelia glanced over at Alistair. He was expressionless, but his hands jammed into his pockets were fists. James had narrowed his eyes. Charles went on merrily, "And lastly, my thanks go out to the folk of the Enclave, who supported my actions as acting consul through our recent troubles. I am young to have borne so much responsibility, but what could I say when duty called? Only this. I am honoured by the trust of my mother, the love of my bride-to-be, and the belief of my people." "Thank you, Charles." James had appeared at Charles's side and had done something rather ingenious with his feet that caused the bench Charles had been standing on to tip over. He caught Charles around the shoulder as he slid to the floor, clapping him on the back. Cordelia doubted most people in the room had noticed anything amiss. "What an excellent speech." Magnus Bain, looking fiendishly amused, snapped his fingers. The loops of golden ribbons dangling from the chandeliers formed the shapes of soaring herons while, "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow," began to play in a ghostly fashion on the unmanned piano. James hustled Charles away from the bench he had clambered onto and into a crowd of well-wishers. The room, as a whole, seemed relieved. "We've raised a fine son, my darling," Will said, kissing Tessa on the cheek. He glanced over at Cordelia and smiled. "And we could ask for no lovelier girl to be his wife." Alistair looked as if he wished to edge away. Cordelia didn't blame him. "Thank you, Mr. Herondale," she said. "I hope I live up to your expectations." Tessa looked surprised. "Why would you ever worry about that?" "Cordelia worries," Alistair said unexpectedly, "because of the idiots who mutter about our father and our family. She should not let them bother her." Tessa laid a gentle hand on Cordelia's shoulder. "The cruel will always spread rumours," she said, "and others who take pleasure in that cruelty will believe them and spread them. But I believe that in the end, truth wins out. Besides," she added with a smile, "the most interesting women are always the most whispered about." "Very true," said Charles, appearing suddenly in their midst. Alistair started violently. "Might I speak to Alistair for a moment? It's a private matter." He took hold of Alistair by the elbow and began to lead him toward one of the more shadowy nooks in the ballroom. Alistair's hand shot out and seized hold of Cordelia's wrist. To her immense surprise, she found herself dragged along after the two of them. When Charles stopped and turned to face Alistair, he looked as surprised as Cordelia felt. "Ah, Cordelia," he said, looking puzzled. "I had hoped to speak to your brother alone." "No," Alistair said, startling Cordelia. "She will remain."
"Chikami koni," Cordelia hissed. "Alistair, what are you doing? I should go."
"I do not wish to speak to you alone, Charles," Alistair went on. "Surely you got my letter." Charles flushed. "I did not think you meant it." "I did," said Alistair. "Anything further you have to say can be said in front of my sister. She will tell no one your secrets." Charles seemed to resign himself. "Very well," he said tightly. I haven't seen you since the meeting. I came by your house, but Risa indicated that you weren't at home. I do not plan to be at home to you ever again, said Alistair evenly. Cordelia attempted another break for freedom, but Alistair was still clamped firmly onto her wrist. I should have left you when you became engaged to Ariadne, he said to Charles, colour flaming in his cheeks. I should have left you when you abandoned her in such a terrible way. Now you are engaged yet again, and I have realised that you will never care half as much for me, or for anyone, as for your career. His grip on Cordelia had loosened. She could have left, had she wanted to, but in that moment she realised Alistair needed her there. She stayed, even as Charles went a greyish colour. Alistair, he said, that is not true. There is no other way. There are other ways, said Alistair. Look at Anna. Look at Magnus Bain. I am not a bohemian, willing to be exiled to the fringes of society. I wish to be the consul, to be part of the clave, to matter. The sound Alistair made was half pain, half exhaustion. And you can have whatever you wish, Charles. You just cannot also have me. I wish to live my life, not to hide in the shadows as you engage yourself to a series of women in an attempt to conceal who you really are. If you chose that for yourself, it is your choice, but you cannot choose for me. That is all you have to say to me, then, after these years. Surely that cannot be all, Charles said, and in that moment he was not ridiculous, as he had been when he was toasting himself. There was genuine grief in his eyes, Cordelia thought. In his way, he loved Alistair. But it was not enough. Some kinds of love weren't. Good luck, Charles, Alistair said. His dark eyes shone. I am sure you will have a very successful life. He walked away. Cordelia, left suddenly and awkwardly alone with Charles, hastened to follow her brother. You must not know what to make of that conversation, Charles said, his voice stiff and overbright as she turned to go. She hesitated, not looking at him. I know you hurt my brother, she said at last. I know you will not do it again. I will not, Charles said very quietly. He said nothing more as she made her escape. James stood on the balcony outside the ballroom. It was a long stone affair, with chest-high railings. It had not existed when his father was a young man, but had been added during the refurbishments to the Institute. Both his parents had a fondness for balconies. It was almost like being up on the roof and far away, but being outside was not having its usual calming effect on him. The air tasted like London, as it always did, and he could see, in the distance, the shapes of houses rising up against the gap of the Thames. He thought of its deep brown-black waters, the colour of the smoke in Belial's realm. His stiff white shirt front scratched against the stone of the balcony as he leaned forward, wishing he could ease the pressure on his chest. It was not that he dreaded marrying Cordelia. He was not dreading it, and he wondered if he ought to be. When he thought of marriage to her, he imagined a warm room, a fire in the grate, a chessboard or a pack of cards laid out, fog pressing against the windows, but the light inside the room gleaming off rows of books in English and Persian. He thought of her soft voice as he fell asleep, reading to him in a language he did not yet know. He told himself he was being a fool. It would be awkward and strange, a peculiar dance they would do for each other's sakes to last out the year until they would be free. Still, when he closed his eyes, James, he knew who she was before he turned around. He always knew her voice. Grace stood behind him, half in shadow, the French doors closing behind her. Through them he could see golden banners and hear music. Magnus Bain has got the piano working somehow, Grace said in her low voice, and people are dancing. James gripped the stone railing of the balcony, staring out toward the city. He had not seen Grace since the enclave meeting, nor had he sent her any kind of message. It would have felt disloyal to Cordelia. It is probably better if we don't speak to each other, you know.
This may be our last chance to speak alone again, Grace said.
When he did not reply, she said, with a catch in her voice, It seems the angel does not want us to be together, doesn't it? First, I could not break things off with Charles because of my mother. Then the moment I was free of her, you became engaged to Cordelia.
Do not say her name, James said, startling even himself with his vehemence. He bowed his head, tasting rain and metal. She is the kindest person.
I know what she did for you, James, said Grace quietly. I know you weren't with her that night. You were in Idris, burning down Blackthorn Manor. I know she told that lie to shield you. I wouldn't have thought she had such cunning in her, really.
It is not cunning, it is generosity, said James. A waste of a year of her life on a marriage she cannot want, just to protect me.
A year, said Grace. Is that the arrangement between you?
I will not discuss this with you, James said. His chest hurt as if it were being compressed. He could barely get enough air.
You must hate me, Grace said, if all this is to protect you from the consequences of what I asked you to do.
I do not blame you, Grace, but we cannot be friends. It will make it harder than it already is.
There was a pause. She was in shadow, but he had seen her in the ballroom, in her green dress with emeralds in her ears.
He had recognized the earrings. They had been Charlotte's. She must have given them to Charles as a gift for Grace.
I am glad you will have Cordelia, Grace said.
I wish I could say the same to you and Charles, said James. Cordelia deserves better than this. I will do everything I can in this next year to make her happy. I hope Charles does the same for you.
I could be with you in a year, she said. Her voice almost a whisper. A long engagement with Charles, you divorce Cordelia. It could be done.
James said nothing. The tightness in his chest had become pain. He felt as if he were being torn in two, brutally and literally.
James, Grace said.
He fought back the words. Yes, wait for me. I will wait for you, Grace. I remember the forest, the shadows, your ivory dress. Grace. He could taste blood in his mouth. He was gripping the railing so hard he thought his fingers might break. A moment later, James heard the soft click of the French door opening and closing. He held himself still for a long minute, and then another. When he turned at last, he was alone on the balcony. There was no sign of Grace. Instead, through the glass, he saw Cordelia. She was dancing with Matthew. Her glorious hair was spilling free of its bandeau, defying all attempts to confine it. They were both laughing. Expertly skirting the couples on the dance floor, Anna sighed. She wanted to be enjoying herself much more than she was. Though she had long ago given up believing in romantic love, she still enjoyed an engagement party, especially when she liked the people who were getting engaged, which admittedly didn't happen all that often. Tonight was different. Many of her favourite people in the enclave were here. The Merry Thieves, various aunts and uncles and extended family members, and, like an especially gaudy bonbon atop an already gilded cake, Magnus Bane. He had been very helpful in setting up wards around her family's house the day Christopher had been attacked. She owed him a favour, but she didn't mind that. She was sure it would be very entertaining when he came to collect. Still, there were two things nagging at her. Although James was one of her favourite cousins, and she very much liked Cordelia, there was something suspicious about this sudden engagement.
Anna had known since the ball welcoming the Carstairs family to London that Cordelia was hopelessly in love with James, and James was hopelessly in love with Grace Blackthorne. She had observed it, noted it, and determined that she would invite Cordelia to tea. Hopeless love was a dreadful state. Perhaps she could talk the girl out of it. She had realised soon enough that Cordelia was tough and stubborn, and that she, Anna, liked her very much. Enough to fervently wish that James would wake up and see what was standing right in front of him. She had thought the dresses might help, and had been quite gratified by the stunned look on James's face when he'd seen Cordelia dance at the Hell Ruel. In fact, Anna might almost have believed James had realised Cordelia was the girl for him. After all, Grace had become engaged to Charles, so that was off the table. Had it not been for Cordelia's sudden announcement at the enclave meeting. There were many things Anna knew she excelled at, and one of them was being a judge of character. Cordelia Carstairs, who blushed at the sight of a seductive gown, was not going to spend the night with a man she was not married to, even if he was the love of her life. Nor would James compromise an unmarried girl. Anna would bet her flat on Percy Street on it. As she slipped through the door at the end of the room, Anna glanced back to see Matthew and Cordelia dancing together. Cordelia looked amused, which was not surprising. Matthew made everyone laugh. She could not see Matthew's face, though there was something in the way he leaned over Cordelia that unsettled Anna. She could not have put a name to it. Will had come out onto the dance floor. Everyone was all smiles as he cut in to dance with Cordelia. Poor Cordelia, Anna thought. It was a shadow hunter tradition to dance with a prospective bride for good luck. Cordelia wouldn't get a moment to herself. She looked happy enough to be dancing with her future father-in-law, at least, as Matthew went off to talk to Thomas. Matthew had also seemed happy as he danced, Anna thought, making her way down the hall to the games room. Hopefully he was coming out of the years-long funk he'd been in. She had been worried. The Merry Thieves were like little brothers to her, and Matthew had always been her companion in scrapes and adventures. The games room was in shadow. Anna liked it here. It was an unfussy room, without ribbons or rosettes or gilt. The chess set her father had given Will gleamed in the moonlight streaming through the window. It spilled like pale fire over the polished floor and the young woman standing in the middle of the room. Ariadne Bridgestock. Ariadne was the second thing that had been nagging at Anna all night. A dozen times now, she had wanted to ask Ariadne if she was well, if she had recovered, and a dozen times she had held herself back. If beauty were a measure of wellness, Ariadne would be the healthiest person at the party. Her dark hair gleamed, her soft brown skin looked like silk, and her lips were full and red. The first lips Anna had ever kissed. The first she had loved. "I am sorry," Anna said, with a slight formal bow. "I didn't realise you were here." She turned to go, but Ariadne hastened across the room to her, holding out a hand. "Anna, please, I want to talk to you." Anna paused, staring at the door. Her heart beat loudly in her ears. She cursed herself quietly. She should be long past feeling this way. So foolish, so young. "I am Anna Lightwood," she told herself. "Nothing touches me."
"I heard you," Ariadne said softly.
Anna turned to stare at her. "What?"
"I heard you when you came to the infirmary," Ariadne said, "and asked me not to die."
Shocked, Anna said, "So, you heard about Charles's betrayal from me?" Ariadne waved that away, her slim gold bracelets chiming like bells.
"It barely mattered to me at all. The only thing that mattered was the realisation that you still have love in your heart for me."
Anna put her hand to the pendant at her throat. Her mother had given it to her when she had been mourning Ariadne's loss. The first and last time Anna had let anyone break her heart.
I've realized that I was wrong, said Ariadne.
To become engaged to Charles, Anna said.
She remembered, 2 years ago, finding Charles at the Bridgestocks' house when she had come with flowers in her hand for Ariadne. How the Bridgestocks had smiled when he kissed Ariadne's hand, even as Anna was ushered out of the room.
There are better men, if marriage is what you insist on.
No, said Ariadne. I was wrong about myself and you. Wrong about what I wanted. She clasped her hands together. What I said years ago, some of it is still true. I do not wish to hurt my parents. I do want to have children. But none of that matters if I do not have love in my life. She smiled wistfully. You have made quite a name for yourself, Anna, as someone who does not believe in love.
Anna spoke coldly. Indeed, I think that romantic love is the cause of all the pain and suffering in this world.
The silk of Ariadne's dress rustled as she moved. A moment later, she was beside Anna, leaning up on her toes to brush her lips against Anna's cheek. When she drew back, her dark eyes were shining. I know you are strong-willed, Anna Lightwood, but I am just as strong-willed. I will change your mind. I will win you back.
She gathered her skirts and strode from the room, the scent of her orange blossom perfume lingering behind her like smoke on the air. You don't mind dancing with an old man like myself, Will said, expertly turning Cordelia about the floor.
She smiled. Will did not have the air of an old man about him. There was something of a boy's mischief in the way he smiled. Strange that neither Jem nor Tessa had aged since the Clockwork War, yet both seemed older and more serious than Will Herondale did. Not at all, she said. For many years when we were growing up, both Alistair and I wished we saw more of you and Mrs. Herondale. We thought of you as an aunt and uncle of sorts.
Now that you will be so close and we will in truth be family, many opportunities present themselves, said Will. A celebration party, perhaps, when your father comes home.
Cordelia blanched. She was sure her father would want nothing of the kind. He would want to forget he had ever been away, because he would not wish to remember why. Will ducked his head to look at her more closely.
Or we can always arrange nothing, if you prefer. Nothing is my favourite thing to arrange. It takes so little effort.
Cordelia smiled wanly.
Will sighed. I joke around a great deal, he said. It is one way in which I manage life in a complex world. But I sense you are not entirely happy about your father coming home.
It is, as you say, complex, said Cordelia. She was faintly aware that the other dancers were looking at them, probably wondering what they were discussing so intently.
I loved my father when I was a child, said Will. I thought he was the best man I'd ever known. Then, when I discovered he had squandered all our money at the gaming tables, I thought he was the worst man I'd ever known. Now that I am myself a father, I know that he was simply a man.
Cordelia looked up at him. Thank you, she said. She wanted to tell Will Herondale that she appreciated his honesty. She wondered how much he knew or guessed about her father. Surely there were rumours. She wished she could be honest in return about her marriage to James. Surely Will must have noticed that James had hardly spoken to her tonight, at this, their engagement party.
Daisy?
Cordelia and Will stopped dancing. She saw with surprise that James had come up to them on the parquet dance floor. The jet and ivory of evening wear perfectly suited his sort of looks, she thought. Already a beauty of contrasts, black and white and gold.
Daisy, he said again, shyly, and
Cordelia barely noticed Will step away from her.
She only saw James's outstretched hand. Would you like to dance?
They looked remarkably happy, Lucy thought.
She would not have found it odd, save that she knew the truth. Still, James and Cordelia were good friends. As she watched, Cordelia laughed at something James said, and he reached to tuck a loose bit of hair back under her bandeau. Perhaps the Merry Thieves had been right. Perhaps the two of them, her best friend and her brother, would find a way to make it all a sort of frolic. "What are you thinking, Luce?" said Thomas, who was leaning against the wall of the ballroom, tie loosened. He had nobly danced several dances with Esme Hardcastle before retreating to the safety of the corner near the refreshments table. Matthew had joined him there, as had Lucy. "You're gazing very thoughtfully at Jamie and Cordelia."
"I was thinking she makes him a better dancer," said Lucy.
Matthew cocked his head to the side. "By the angel," he said, "marriage. Did you know James asked me to be his sous-genace?" In Shadowhunter marriage ceremonies, your sous-genace was the one who escorted you down the aisle. You could pick anyone in your life, mother, father, brother, best friend.
"Well, that's not odd," Lucy said. "Parabatai almost always pick each other."
"It does make one feel very grown up," said Matthew. He was drinking from the flask in his hand, which to Lucy was not a good sign. Usually at parties where spirits were provided, Matthew would be seen with a wine glass in hand. If he were getting his drain of pale from his flask, he must be very determined indeed to be as drunk as possible. His eyes were glittering too, rather dangerously. Perhaps he was angry at Charles, angry at his parents for accepting Charles's marriage to Grace so easily. Though how could they know? Lucy wondered, glancing at Henry and Charlotte, where they sat at a table at the far end of the room. Henry's bath chair stood sentry against the wall, and the consul and her husband leaned together, talking softly, their hands entwined. "Although," he added, his eyes narrowing as he gazed past Thomas, "not grown up enough to put up with that." Lucy looked over and saw Alistair Carstairs moving through the crowd toward them. His shoulders were slightly hunched, and his once again dark hair made him look like a different person. "Be polite to him, Matthew," said Thomas, straightening. "He was a great help to me when I needed to make the antidote." "Has anyone tried the lemon tarts?" said Alistair lightly as he arrived among their group. "You have an excellent cook, Lucy." Lucy blinked. Matthew set his jaw. "Do not try to make small talk, Alistair," he said. "It gives me a headache." "Matthew," said Thomas severely, "do you need to go sit down?" Matthew shoved his flask back into his jacket with shaking hands. "I do not," he said. "I need Carstairs to leave us alone. Tonight is difficult enough." There was no chance for Lucy to ask why tonight might be difficult, for Alistair had already cut in. He seemed half annoyed and half abashed, his voice even but tense. "Can we not put our school days behind us?" he said. "If I admit I was a cad, is that enough? How can I apologise?" "You cannot," said Matthew, his voice very strange, and they all looked at him. Lucy had the odd sense she was watching someone balanced on a knife's edge. Matthew seemed all sharp angles in that moment, as if he were made of daggers beneath the skin. "Do not think you are our friend now, or welcome among us, regardless of all that has happened." Thomas frowned. "Matthew," he said, his usually gentle voice remonstrative, "that was the past. It is time for us to be adults and forget childish slights." "Thomas, you are kind," said Matthew, "too kind, and you wish to forget. But I am not kind, and I cannot help but remember." The light had gone from Alistair's eyes, yet he did not, to Lucy's surprise, look angry. He looked almost resigned. "Let him say what he wants to say, Thomas." "You have no right to talk to Thomas in that familiar way," said Matthew. "I never told you this, Thomas. I couldn't bear to. But better that you know the truth than you allow this snake to befriend you." "Matthew," Thomas began impatiently. "Do you know what he used to say at school?" Matthew said, that my mother and your father were lovers, that I was your father's bastard. He told me that Henry was only half a man and couldn't father children, and therefore Gideon had stepped into the breach. He said that your mother was so hideously ugly because of her scarred face that no one could blame your father for looking elsewhere, and that you were a sickly, ugly little thing because you had inherited her weakness of constitution, because she had been a mundane, but not just a mundane, a servant and a whore. Matthew stopped on a sort of gasp, as if even he could not quite believe what he had just said. Thomas stood stock still, the colour draining from his face. Alistair had not moved either. It was Lucy who said, to her own surprise,
"He was the source of that awful rumour. Alistair?"
Not the source," Alistair said, his voice sounding as if he were forcing it through a tight throat. "And I did not say all of those things to Matthew." "But you did say them to others," Matthew said icily. "I have heard all about it in the years since." "Yes," Alistair admitted flatly. "I did spread the story. I repeated those words. I did do that." He turned to Thomas. Don't say you are sorry." Thomas's lips were grey. "You think I have not heard that tale?" "Of course I have, though Matthew may have tried to protect me. I have heard my mother weep over it, my father incoherent with rage and sorrow, my sisters crushed with shame over lies." He broke off, breathless. "You repeated those words without knowing or caring if they were true. How could you?" "They were just words," said Alistair. "I did not think..." "You are not who I thought you were," Thomas said, each word cold and sharp. "Matthew is right. This is your sister's engagement party, and, for Cordelia's sake, we will mind our manners toward you, Carstairs. But if you come near me, or speak to me at any point after this, I will knock you into the Thames." Lucy had never in her life heard Thomas speak so icily. Alistair backed away, his expression stunned. Then he turned on his heel and darted into the crowd. Lucy heard Matthew murmur something to Thomas, but she did not stay to hear what. She was already racing after Alistair. He ran like there were wings on his feet, and she bolted after him, through the ballroom doors, down the stone steps, finally catching up to him in the entryway.
"Alistair, wait!" she cried.
He spun around to look at her and she realised to her shock that he had been crying. In a strange way, she was reminded of the first time she had ever seen a man cry, the day her father had found out his parents were dead. Alistair dashed the tears furiously from his eyes.
"What do you want?"
Lucy was almost relieved to hear him sound so much himself.
"You can't leave."
"What?" he sneered. "Don't you hate me too?"
"It doesn't matter what I think. This is Cordelia's engagement party. You are her brother. It will break her heart if you vanish, and so I say you will not go."
He swallowed hard. "Tell Leila, tell Cordelia, that I have a bad headache and am resting in our carriage. There is no need for her to rush or spoil her evening."
"Alistair!"
But he was gone, out into the night. Lucy turned back towards the stairs, dispirited. At least Alistair wasn't leaving the Institute, but she would have preferred... She jumped. Standing in a niche among the shadows was Grace, her pale green dress almost luminous in the dimness. She grimaced when she saw Lucy.
"I suppose it looks as if I have been eavesdropping," she said. "I assure you, however, I had no desire to overhear any of that."
Lucy put her fists on her hips.
"Then why were you here?"
"I was already on the steps," said Grace. "I heard you galumphing down and decided it would be preferable to hide than to engage in conversation."
"You were leaving," said Lucy, "weren't you?"
Grace said nothing. She was standing very upright, not leaning against the wall. Lucy recalled something that James had said to her once about Tatiana forcing Grace to walk back and forth in the parlour of Blackthorn Manor with a book balanced on her head to perfect her posture.
"You know," Lucy said, feeling very weary, "you don't have to marry Charles."
Grace rolled her eyes.
"Please don't worry yourself. I am not impatient to be gone because of some excess of hurt feelings. And don't bother telling me James doesn't really want to marry Cordelia. I know that, too."
Lucy froze.
"I would never have said that."
"No," said Grace.
"I suppose you wouldn't."
Lucy blew out an exasperated breath.
"I know you think we have nothing in common," she said, "but I am the only other person in the world who knows about your brother, who knows the secret you're protecting."
Grace went still.
"You saw Jesse in Idris," she said. "I spoke with him. I know that he told you not to help him, and I know that you Herondales are honourable."
She practically spat the word.
"If he asked you not to help him, you won't. What use do you imagine I have for yet another person who won't help my family?"
Lucy raised her chin.
"That shows how well you know me, Miss Blackthorn. I have every intention of doing all I can to help Jesse, whether he wants me to or not."
Grace stepped forward, out of the shadows. Her green earbobs danced in the light like the jewelled eyes of cats.
"In that case," she said, "do tell me more."
It did not take Magnus long to find Matthew Fairchild, leaning against the wall near the door to the withdrawing room, his necktie entirely undone. Magnus stood for a moment, looking at him. Matthew was exactly the sort of person Magnus always wanted to help, and later scolded himself roundly for having tried to help. In Magnus's life, there had been 100 Matthew Fairchilds, young men and women as self-destructive as they were beautiful, who, despite all the gifts that had been given to them, seemed to wish for no more than to burn down their own lives. He told himself over and over that the Matthew Fairchilds of this world could not be saved, and yet he could not stop himself from trying. He leaned against the wall next to Matthew. He wondered why Matthew had chosen to stand here, half hidden from the rest of the room by a pillar. He seemed to be staring rather blankly at the dance floor. "I have always heard," Magnus said, "that it was rude for a gentleman to be a wallflower." "Then you must also have heard that I am generally considered to be very rude," said Matthew. There was a flask in his right hand, and a ring with the insignia of the Fairchilds sparkled on his finger. Magnus had long observed to himself that a man who brought his own drink to a party where drinks were provided was indeed in a sorry state. But the real question was, he thought, why no one else seemed to notice that Matthew was only standing up because the wall was holding him. Ordinarily, it would not have struck Magnus as particularly strange. Getting tipsy at a party was nothing unusual for a boy of 17. But Matthew had been drunk when they were at Tower Bridge as well, though a less expert eye than Magnus's might never have spotted it. A less expert eye might not spot it now. It wasn't the drinking, Magnus thought, so much as the fact that Matthew was clearly practiced at pretending he had not been drinking. Magnus said mildly, "I had thought that I might be an exception, since you said you admired my waistcoats." Matthew did not answer. He was still looking at the dance floor, though not just at the crowd of dancers themselves, but rather a specific couple, Cordelia Carstairs and James Herondale. Another Carstairs binding themselves to another Herondale. Magnus had been amused when he'd heard about the engagement. He thought he recalled James having muttered about some other girl to him the first time they'd met, but Romeo himself had once thought himself in love with a girl named Rosaline. It was clear from the way James and Cordelia looked at each other that this was a love match. It was also clear why Matthew was standing where he was. From this vantage point, there was a perfect view of James and Cordelia, his dark head bent over her fiery one, their faces close together. Magnus cleared his throat. I see why my waistcoats cannot hold your attention, Fairchild. I've been where you are. Wanting what you can't have will only rip your heart apart. Matthew spoke in a low voice. It would be one thing if James loved her. I would go into the quiet dark like Jem did and never speak of her again. But he doesn't love her. What? Magnus was unpleasantly startled. This is a false marriage, said Matthew. It's only for a year. Magnus tucked the information away as a mystery to be solved. It did not go along with what he knew of the Herondales, father or son. And yet, Magnus said, during that year, they are man and wife. Matthew looked up, his green eyes flashing. And during that year, I will do nothing. What kind of person do you think I am? I think, said Magnus very slowly, that you are a person who is incredibly sad, although I don't know why. And I think that, as an immortal, I can tell you that a great deal can happen in a year. Matthew did not reply. He was watching Cordelia and James. Everyone in the room was. They were dancing close together, and Magnus would have cheerfully bet £1,000 that they were in love. A bet, it seemed, he would have lost. And yet. Oh dear, Magnus thought. I may need to linger in London a bit longer. Perhaps I should send for my cat. It was as if no time had passed since Cordelia's first ball in London, and yet everything had changed. She felt a million miles from the anxious girl who had come to London, desperate to make friends and allies, who had seen in every face a stranger. Now she had friends, a richness of friends. She could see Anna at the entrance to the ballroom, speaking cheerfully to Christopher. There was Thomas, seated with his sister, and Matthew, beside Magnus Bain. And Lucy, her Lucy, who would one day stand with her in the blazing circles of the Parabatai ceremony. Daisy, said James with a smile. It was a real smile, though she could not quite tell if he was happy or sad or something in between. What are you thinking? One thing had not changed. Her heart still beat too fast when she danced with James. I was thinking, she said, it must be strange to you that Belial's realm was destroyed. One dark eyebrow flicked upward, a flourish of ink across a page. What do you mean? It was a place only you could see, she said, that only you could go. Now it is gone. It is like an enemy that you have known a long time. Even if you hated it, it must be strange to think of never seeing it again. No one else has understood that. James was looking at her with a gentle, puzzling tenderness, the mask entirely gone now. He drew her closer to him. We must think of this as an adventure, Daisy. She could feel his heart beat against her own. Think of what as an adventure? Being married, James said fiercely. I know you gave up a great deal for me, and I never want you to regret it. We will live together as the best of friends. I will help you train for your Parabatai ceremony. I will defend and support you always. You need never be lonely. I will always be there. His lips brushed her cheek. Remember how well we did in the whispering room, James whispered, and she shivered at the feeling of his warm breath against her skin. We fooled them all. We fooled them. So it had been as she feared, despite what he had said and perhaps believed at the time. It had been real to her, but not to him. A strange and bitter pleasure. I suppose, James said, I am saying that I know this is an odd experience, but I hope you can be at least a little happy, Daisy. His hair was tumbling over his forehead. Cordelia recalled the 1,000 times she had wanted to push it back from his face. This time she did, reaching up to brush it away from his eyes. She smiled a smile as false as it was bright.
I am, she said, a little bit happy.
The dimple flashed in his cheek. I'm glad to hear it, he said, and drew her closer for the next step in the dance. She remembered the ball, when he had left her on the floor and walked to Grace. He would not do that now. He was too honourable. She had him, for this year, a year of bitter joy. She would have her father back as well. She would stay in London and be parabatai with Lucy. She had everything she had wanted, and yet none of it the way she had imagined. She thought of what James had said about fairy fruit, that the more you had of it, the more you wanted, and the more you ached when it was gone. And yet, was not knowing what it was like to taste it not also a form of torment? She loved James. She always would. So many people loved without hope of return, without the dream of a touch or a glance from the object of their affection. They pined away in silence and misery, like mortals starving for fairy fruit. What fate was offering her now was a year of such fruit for her table. A year of living with James and loving him might ruin her for any other love, but oh, at least she would blaze up in glory. For a year she would share his life. They would walk together, read together, eat together, and live together. They would laugh together. For a year she would stand close to the fire and know what it was like to burn.